Hello, everybody, and welcome to another live stream of the LCI Green Room, Open and Unscripted. I am Jacob Winograd. I'm the host of the Biblical Anarchy podcast here at the Libertarian Christian Institute, part of our Christians for Liberty network. Please, if you haven't already, subscribe wherever you're watching. If it's on YouTube, make sure you give this video a thumbs up. I'm here tonight with a special guest, Mr. Clint Russell of the Liberty Lockdown podcast and this other weird podcast that we don't talk about in the Liberty movement. Clint, how you doing tonight?
That's right. I am the proud co-host of Tower Gang. also the best political show with Luke Radowski. So I do too many shows, but I'm hanging in there. I'm doing good. Doing better than the economy, which I guess we're going to talk about. So, yeah, let's do it.
the economy. You know, it's although immigration is certainly an issue in this year's election.
Maybe no, it's more not. So than open borders. Past. Open borders is the only answer. Sorry.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. I forgot to download the last software patch. Yeah. You know, it's like we could talk about that, too. But, you know, that conversation has been beat to death.
Yes,
by many podcasters, including me having Dave on last month, which then caused a whole bunch of stupid drama, which usually happens whenever Dave says anything anymore. Yep. But, you know, the economy is something that I've been meaning to get, you know, just focus more on in terms of my content and specifically talking to my audience, which is primarily Christians. I feel there's a lot of Christians out there who, in the same way that they'll check out a politics, they view economics in the same vein. They think, well, this is just stock markets. This is just people. You know, the only reason I would care about this is for my own 401k and maybe my investments there. But then, you know, increasingly a lot of people in the middle class, it's kind of like, what investments? Like, I don't have anything left at the end of the paycheck to invest. So, yeah. Whatever. And the extent to which I hear a lot of evangelicals and Christians even care about the economy, they just attribute it to simple, like, well, I could afford stuff when Trump was in office and Biden's in office now and everything is 10 times more expensive. So clearly this all just started with Biden and there's not any history to this that, you know, the Republican Party or Trump could be partially blamed for. And I'm someone who comes from the left. So I used to be very, you know, backwards in my economic thinking, and after discovering the Austrian school, you know, I kind of came to it that way. But you actually have a career background in these kind of things. Maybe just to share a little bit about your experience, because I've heard you talk about it on your show, but I haven't had a chance to actually talk to you about it, and I'd like to just get to know more about like how that brought you into this world of libertarianism and kind of like the experiences you've had in the world of business and how they kind of, you know, shaped your political journey. So why don't you go ahead and share that with us?
Yeah, I mean, my business background did not bring me into libertarianism. I'm a second gen libertarian, so I was raised into it. But you know, my business background just really emphasized the accuracy of Austrian economics and convinced me that it was correct. So I was a private money mortgage lender or broker. I ran my own company for a little over a decade and managed a ton of money and invested in a ton of real estate, you know, purchases and things like that. And also bought a bunch of real estate myself and was a landlord, had Airbnbs, did a ton of stuff, built a bunch of houses. So yeah, I've done it all in the real estate finance sector. the main thing that I guess I learned from it was just that malinvestment is very, very real. there are market signals that are thrown off in such a fundamental way because of the interest rate manipulation that comes from the central bank. And that for me is actually ultimately why I left the market and left the industry entirely, and why I'm no longer really an active investor, is that the malinvestment is just so rampant. It's impossible as a fiduciary to do, you know, proper due diligence or properly evaluate these things, because the reality is that the entire economy hinges on Fed policy at this point. Like that's as simple as I can put it. Like every single asset class across the board is predicated off of the printing press and the interest rates that are set by the Federal Reserve. It's that's the truth. So I don't know why anybody as a professional money manager to advise your investors on this is a good investment, this is a safe investment. I think you're just lying. I just think everybody that's doing it is lying at this point, because the reality is that Powell could come out tomorrow and he could say, we are hiking the Fed funds rate from, you know, 5 to 10 and just obliterate the economy, like obliterate it. That's the truth. Or he could say, we're lowering it back down to the zero bound over the next, you know, two meetings, and the economy would absolutely go into hyperinflation, but also boom, like you've never seen it before. So who knows, though? Who knows what they're going to do? I don't trust these scumbags. Why would I possibly trust my investments in this market? So this is why I've become, you know, more and more of a Bitcoiner.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, so when I was first getting into libertarianism, I had spent a couple years starting to get into the field of like life insurance and security sales. So I'd got like my life insurance license here in the state of Pennsylvania, and I'd started you know, working to get my securities license to sell securities. But I kind of came to the same conclusion, like as I became more aware, and this was like back before things got even this bad, this was like 2019, and I was like, yeah, I don't know if I could in good faith tell people to be putting their money into this system I'm slowly losing faith in, because you know what I mean, it's like you know, if someone's on the tail end of their, you know, career, I guess that's one thing. But if I'm telling people like my age to like, oh, be investing into the, you know, stock market or things like that to set up your retirement in 30, 40 years, it's just like I feel like I'd be, you know, lying through my teeth. And so that took a different career path out of that.
To clarify, I'm not saying that all money managers are lying. I'm saying that the money managers that aren't lying are too stupid to know that they're lying.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, they honestly don't know. But regardless, like, do you want to trust your money with someone who doesn't understand actually how the system works? Like, I would say that's not advisable either. So my opinion is, like, the only good money manager is a retired one at this junction.
So you mentioned the Federal Reserve and the interest rates and all that. And again, this is going to be like 101, you know, Austrian 101 for people who have heard this before. But again, I don't know. My audience is split 50-50 between hardcore libertarians and Christians at the various, you know, my church and other churches who I've reached out to and, you know, who are curious to learn more about this stuff. So, you know, when people don't understand necessarily the relationship between the Federal Reserve and the central bank and all the other banks, sure, and how that works. So the Federal Reserve sets interest rates, and some people might just think like, well, duh, like what other options are there? You know what I mean? Like compared to the ideal, why is the Federal Reserve having a monopoly on interest rates bad for the economy? How does that lead to malinvestment? Because I understand what you're saying when you say that. It's very intuitive to me. But to other people, this is something that, you know, and there's, you know, millions of books we could recommend as well, but just to kind of give people the basic idea of how this,
of course,
you know, warps the economy. I'd love to get into that.
I can make it very, very simple. So the Federal Reserve, the chair or the board, they set the Fed funds rate. The Fed funds rate is the rate at which banks lend to one another, and they ultimately, it serves as kind of like the underpinning for all other interest rates, and they can also do, you know, quantitative easing and a whole bunch of advanced things that I'd have to actually read again to explain it properly, but people can do their own research if they want to figure that all out. But so they can manipulate the yield curve on treasuries. They can do just like almost godlike powers, honestly, when it comes to interest rates. But because they set the rates for their partner banks, that trickles into the entire economy. And because the US dollar is the reserve currency of the world, that then has knock-on effects on the entire world. That is way too much power for anybody to have, much less a unelected bureaucrat, much less a handful of, you know, oligarchical bank managers. It's totally crazy that we permit this system to exist. But so to explain the reason that malinvestment happens is that when you lower interest rates, it makes the cost of borrowing far cheaper. You know, if you get a mortgage at 3%, the interest that you're going to pay on that is going to be far lower than if you get the interest rate locked in at 6 or 7 or 8%. So because of that, it means that you're able to purchase, I'll just use housing because that's how most people understand this stuff anyways. If you lock in at a lower percentage rate, that means that you can actually have a much lower monthly payment, which means that you can buy a much more expensive house. So when interest rates are held low for an extended period of time, that means that there's increased demand for housing, and not just increased demand, but also increased demand at higher and higher prices because you're able to borrow more money and have a lower monthly payment. Once you extrapolate across the entire economy, that also creates knock-on effects in every asset class, because then you have equity in your home because the market is artificially inflated. A lot of those people take out home equity lines of credit or HELOCs. They borrow against these assets. They then use them to go on vacations. That bolsters the economy. All of this stuff, though, is at its core being done on debt, not sound investment. And as long as an economy is predicated off of debt, it's not very foundationally sound. And I think that's what we're witnessing, right, is a very unsound economic model. So when the Federal Reserve ultimately realizes, oh, inflation is running hot, as if you shouldn't have known that, you absolute imbeciles. But what they do is they hike the Fed funds rate. That has the exact opposite effect, where it starts to drive down demand for housing and all sorts of other asset classes. And it can ultimately create what's called a deflationary spiral, where assets start to decline in value. And that can create really catastrophic circumstances like we saw in 2008, 2009, where you have insolvency in the banking sector. We already saw a small example of that with Silicon Valley Bank and a handful of others a little over a year ago. So there is already, and this was like right after Powell started to hike rates. So I think that was a consequence of that. I think that because they created the BTFP, the Bank Term Finance Program, that kicked the can down the road, that ended allegedly a month ago. But now we're kind of in this like limbo period where, as far as I'm concerned, we're just waiting for the hat to drop.
Yeah. No, you said
I said a lot, but I hope that made some sense.
No, it's good. One thing you said, which, again, I'm comparing this to remembering things I used to believe when I was, more of a lefty. I was kind of like a Bernie bro, democratic socialist type. And I remember watching this old debate when I was still kind of like, so after I left the left and I was kind of like politically homeless, I would just sit and listen to tons and tons of just political debates and podcasts, which is partly how I found Dave Smith and ended up where I'm at today. But I listened to a debate between Cenk Uygur and Ben Shapiro, which, like, say what you want about those two.
Annoying.
People.
that's an annoying debate.
It really was. Although it's funny to see, like, in like recent events, I'm like been cheering Cenk on just because he's been good on the Israel stuff. So
sure,
a little funny. But remember, Cenk was talking about like, well, this is just basic economics, that when we, when we print money and we spend money, this puts money into the economy. It circulates money around. And that's how that is how you're taught in school. Like, I remember taking, economic classes and whatnot. And it is basically like just tracking how much money gets spent, and everything that you're taught through the filter of the New Deal post-World War II was just that, like, oh no, like, people saving money and money being, fixed to things like gold and silver, that this was a disaster, right? And so we needed to have the ability to print money so that we can, it's basic Keynesian theory. It's like, to be able to, dump money into the economy when it's going down, and then during the recovery, you pay off the debt. Of course, in reality, it's like...
You don't.
they never do that. And part of that is because, as you mentioned, the health of an economy is not measured really in spending. Spending can be a marker of a good economy, but if the spending is entirely funded by debt, that's kind of like someone who's like, hey, all my credit cards are maxed out. Look how financially fit I am. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
The real health stems from, productivity and innovation. And those are the things that, while we are still fairly good at those things, it's a less and less of a driving factor behind our GDP and our actual economic growth. Like, our real economic system is based off of the money printing and interest rate manipulation. Like, that is the primary driver of our economic system, and it has been for a very long time. That is not sustainable. That is how you ultimately see a country, come crumbling down. And now we're talking about $35 trillion $70 trillion in national debt. That does not include the unfunded liabilities, which are over $70 trillion. We're talking $100+ trillion. That's insane. I mean, it's absolutely insurmountable sums of money. And I'm my personal opinion is that we will see either a hyperinflation, or if we have some sort of Volcker figure who was responsible for hiking the Fed funds rate up to 20%, the overnight rate, in the 1980s, like, unless that guy arises, which I don't see that happening. But if it were to, that would create, you know, a like a depression on the scale that we've never seen before either. So either pathway is extremely painful. But it's also inevitable because we have zero political will to do the right thing. And we also have zero economic understanding across the board when it comes to the American people. I mean, maybe 5% of the population understands like anything that we're talking about right now. So there's no political will at all. Right. So it's not going to be fixed. It's not.
So I feel like part of the problem here, too, is that when people hear us talking about these things, sorry, my dog's whining in the background. But when people hear these things, they can sometimes be maybe turned off from it because there's like a, I don't know, like a little bit of fear that comes into it, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So they're thinking, well, you're spelling all this kind of like doom and gloom and like it's bad either way. So what am I supposed to do? People kind of talk themselves out of looking into it more. And so one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is like, if people are getting into this and they're hearing the things we talk about, they realize how the Federal Reserve plays into creating all these malincentives, so people are, you know, spending money where they shouldn't, not saving money when they shouldn't, you know, et cetera. And it's like, well, then you're saying don't invest the money into the economy. Well, then what should I be doing? You know, if I, like, say, a lot of people are in my position. Like, I got four kids, a fifth on the way. You know, what should we be doing with the money that we do have left over to try to protect ourselves in a time of economic instability? There's a lot of people who they don't have the faintest idea of where to go because we've been growing up, you know, like almost handicapped to be dependent on the system, and trying to think outside of it is scary. But I think that there's a lot of people who have good ideas of what we should be doing. And I think we should be talking about that more, because if people are able to, I mean, as much as I think you would agree with me that, you know, liberty is more important than security, people aren't going to care about liberty if they don't make that connection that, right, like that liberty gives you security. So
I mean, just in terms of advice that I would give people, or that I do give people, is that I like the entrepreneurial path is what you ought to be investing in. Like, you ought to be investing in yourself and your family and your community. Like, in terms of investing in the stock market, you can still make outsized gains. You could still make a killing potentially, like, especially if they lower interest rates and the market booms again in some sort of hyperinflationary period, you can make a crazy amount of money. The issue is, will that money be worth anything? will you be able to buy much with it? And if you've been to the grocery store lately, the answer is no. It's gonna be painful. So the answer, in my opinion, is to you got to keep in mind, too, in either of these dynamics I'm talking about, it's going to be hard on everybody. Like, it's going to be challenging for sure. So there's no reason to give up. The reason that this information is so valuable is that it gives you a first leader advantage over everybody else in the market, is that when you start to see the signs that I'm capable of seeing, you'll be able to act faster than the rest of the people in the market that have no idea what we're talking about right now. So, for instance, I bought a ton of houses in 2009, 2010, 11, 12, because I was like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy housing, because I knew it was, you know, we were in a deflationary bust. It happened. It very rarely happens, but it did. So that, like, when that happens again, if it happens again, you will have a huge opportunity to buy whatever asset class you want. And in that case, you're going to be wanting to focus on liquidity right now, or at least have lines of credit that you'll have access to in a deflationary bust. So that's one way to hedge. You want to make sure that your credit's right. You want to make sure that you have access to lines of credit. You want to make sure that you have some liquid capital, or at least asset classes that are able to be liquidated quickly, you know, T-bills or CDs or something like that. So those are all, that's like one hedge. If we end up in a deflationary spiral, you have a life-changing opportunity in front of you. You'll be able to buy your dream home, or maybe four rental properties or something crazy like that. You could do a lot to change your life dramatically. So there's no reason to be hopeless if there's a deflationary spiral, as long as you have been the type that has been a saving and investing, preparing type of person. On the inverse of that, if we go the hyperinflationary route, which I say the odds are slightly in that favor, then you're going to want to have, you know, precious metals, gold, silver. You're going to want to you're going to want to actually possess it, because it's like the all the derivatives contracts and all the like BS ETFs are just nonsense. I think that they're manipulated terribly anyway. So you're going to want to own it physically. And then Bitcoin. Like I'm a real believer that that is a great hedge against hyperinflation. So like those are the things that you can invest in. There's certainly not like it's not as vast as pick any Fortune 500 company, but it's still lots of options. And there's lots of reasons for optimism, because you will have a competitive advantage over literally everyone in your life. Because I'm telling you, in 2009-10, when I was telling everybody this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to buy housing, no one did it. Not a single person I know did it. I was the only one. And I was buying as aggressively as I possibly could. So, like, even when I tell people this stuff, they still won't prepare for it. Like, most of the people watching right now, you're going to go like, oh, that's interesting. And you're going to do nothing. You're going to do nothing to actually prepare yourself. That's on you. I can't do it for you. Sorry, I sound like Andrew Tate. I'm like challenging people, but it's the truth. It's the truth. Yeah. Like most people aren't going to do shit. Like that's just the honest to God's truth. But you have an opportunity either way. As long as you are actually like preparing, and hedging in both directions, you will have an opportunity that will put you light years ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, no, I think that this touches on a little bit what you were saying, that exchange, some like back and forth quote tweets I saw from, Top and Matt Walsh, mm-hmm. which and I could kind of see a little bit of where both of them were coming from.
Yeah, I totally got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Matt's point was like, you know, well, listen, like there's nothing wrong with like people just wanting to like, you know, work a job, just have that be like not an important part of their life. And then they want to make money and then, you know, spend, you know, most of their time and energy with their family or doing their hobbies and things like that. And that's sort of like my default mode. My default mode is not necessarily in more of an entrepreneurial or risk-taking sort of mindset. Yeah. But
most people aren't entrepreneurs.
Right. And I think Top's point was, okay, but like the society that we live in today is such that a lot of people who are just doing that are going to either, I mean, like even if they make it, like, because I was going to say they're not going to make it, like some of them might not make it. And even if they do make it, they're going to be, you know, become more dependent on and more enslaved to the system, which Matt Walsh is, you know, as a, you know, one of the biggest conservative commentators, you know, in America, who speaks against sort of the regime in certain aspects, although he can sometimes also be a useful idiot for them at times as well. And I think this can be one of those instances, is that sort of like, if you're not encouraging people to sort of like get out of that mindset of just playing it safe, then you might be feeding into the pattern of where they, I mean, this is what happened with the lockdowns, right? Like a lot of people did not want, because like I really hate when I hear people in these debates about the COVID stuff. They'll be like, oh, well, you know, the majority of the population got vaccinated. So, I mean, you know, like, and I'm like, you know, like most of that was based on coercion, where it was like, you know, get the jab or you lose your job.
Sure.
That was a huge problem. I remember at the Pennsylvania LP presidential debate, this new guy who came out of nowhere, was his name a Belay, who's been on the LP presidential circuit now, was going on about like, oh man, you know, he was arguing with Josh and he was like, we were having such a hard time, we needed volunteers, we needed nurses, there was such a nursing shortage. And I got so mad, I just stood up and started yelling at him. I was like, you guys fired all the nurses, what are you talking about? Like, you had nursing shortages, like the nurses just decided randomly like, oh, we don't want to be nurses anymore. But anyway, the point I'm getting at being that and you know, sort of what Matt and Top were sort of arguing about is that, yeah, like maybe in a you know, if we had a real economy, then there's nothing wrong with you know, saying, yeah, working a 9 to 5 or 7 to 4, whatever, is fine. But I think with where we're at today, especially if you have people counting on you, you might need to push yourself a little bit outside your comfort zone, because if you don't do that now, then you will at some point, you know, have your back against the wall, and you're going to have to make really tough choices then.
Oh, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of people that think that they want to start a business, and then they go like, oh, I'll do it next year. And then they get laid off during a recession, and they go, oh, well, now I got to do it. And now you don't really have the resources. Now you're like scrambling. You're just trying to pay your mortgage. And it's like, well, then you just go get a job because you have to. You have to pay the bills. And that is not a way to get ahead. Like, basically what I'm saying is this. In this current economic system, in the conditions that we currently face, there is no easy way out. It is going to require effort. It's going to require a commitment. It's going to require planning. It's going to require more of you than most people are willing to give. And this is why most people aren't rich. That's the truth. So if you want to be the type that actually survives and thrives during whichever, you know, terrible economic condition I'm describing in the not too distant future, it's on you, you know. And that's the problem, is that isn't the type of thing that most people want to hear. And that's not the type of thing that like gets a ton of listeners or subscribers or anything like that. You know, you just like, cause people come to you and they're like, hey, give me advice. And I'm like, hey, here's the advice. You do it. And they're like, hey, screw you. I wanted you to fix everything for me. Well, that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to tell you actually what you're facing. And if that's not enough of an inspiration for you to get off the couch and go get after it, that's on you. Most people aren't equipped for this type of stuff. But to top point about entrepreneurialism, I think the key is that, you know, as I said, most people don't have what it takes to be an entrepreneur, but there's a huge amount of people that do. And if you have that fire in you, you will find yourself capable of working more than you have ever worked before, and it'll feel like you're working less than you ever have before. I mean, it's very similar to how I've felt over the past 3 years, even though I went from an entrepreneur to an entrepreneur. Because I'm doing what I'm even more passionate about, I get after it all the time. I don't care. I never take a day off. I never feel like I'm, you know, overtaxed. Sometimes I feel tired, obviously, but like, because I'm focused on what I'm passionate about in life, and that's what entrepreneurialism allows you to pursue, is what you're most passionate about. And if you're ever going to succeed to the highest levels in any industry, you have to be passionate. There's no way you can fake that. Like the best basketball players, they love basketball. The best, you know, mortgage brokers, they love that. I know it sounds crazy. I genuinely loved it. That's the truth. I really did. I loved making people money. I loved evaluating investment opportunities. It's like that vibes with me. You know what vibes with me even more? Talking about how corrupt the government is. Like that really gets me out of bed. So that's the reason that I encourage, this is why I side with Top in this whole, you know, kerfuffle, is that I'm not interested in shaming someone who has a 9-to-5 job. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. You can do that. Like I said, most people, that's probably what you're best equipped for. But for those that aren't best equipped for that, we need you. We need you in this fight. We need you to be wealthy. We need you to actually be getting after it and creating wealth for your family and creating wealth so that you can have a larger family. Like, all of these things matter. So for those rare few that are listening right now, yes, I want you to be inspired. I do not want you to give up hope. But simultaneously, if you're not that type of person, God bless. Go do your 9-to-5 and, you know, hope for the best.
I mean, at the very least, like, if you're not someone who has an entrepreneurial spirit, I would encourage you to at least consider having more than one source of income. I mean, not even, and you know, that's what I do. It's
diversification.
Because I have my income, my income comes a lot from my main job, but then I have side jobs as well. And I don't need the side jobs, but the side jobs give me financial freedom that I can then use that money and use that to, I mean, one, I had to do it to pay off debts that I incurred because of the consequences of the COVID lockdowns, and I had a huge career change and all that. But now it's like I'm rebuilding, and it's like I'm not in my risk tolerance is different than someone who is single without kids, but I still know I can't just be sitting still. I can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, I need to be doing as much as I can to, you know, make investments, make moves and whatnot to put my family in a good position. And so I think that's the whole idea of what that conversation Top and Matt was having. I think Matt is still operating like we're living in America as it was in like 1995. It's like we're so far
or 1965. I mean, he's like, you work, you know, 40 years, you get your pocket watch and you get your pension at the end of the day. It's like, that doesn't exist, Matt. Okay, So if you want to lead your audience astray, feel free. I understand he talks to the everyman. The vast majority of his listeners are 9-to-5 employees because they're sitting in this rudderless, lifeless job, and they're like the only thing that keeps them alive is to have Matt Walsh railing against the system in their ear while they're at work. So he's not gonna want to, you know, put those people off. I get that, but that's not who I try to talk to. I try to talk to like the people that are looking to be inspired. That because that's what I want to see people do. I want to see people be great. Like we need, especially people that like share our value set. I want them to really be great. So that's why I'm, you know, I'll kind of drop the pleasantries and just tell the truth. Like if you want to be great, you're going to have to put in a lot of work, and you're going to have to risk something. And I hope more people do, because at the end of the day, like because of the ESG and the DEI framework, if you have any intention of telling the truth in your life, you're not going to be able to work for a Fortune 500 company. Like that doesn't exist anymore. Like if you go in there and you start talking about anything basically, and you tell the truth, you're going to get fired.
Everything has a cost, right? It's like, it's like, listen, you can take the low cost of, the easy route of just, like the working for somebody else. But then, you know, that might be a low upfront cost, but then the long-term cost is your integrity, your soul, your ability to speak freely. So I think that's a big deal, something that people need to consider. And in terms of, you know, what you were talking about in terms of like it's hard work, I think of biblical principles, you know, that's my sort of my niche here in the liberty movement. There's the Matthew principle that to him who has much, more will be given, to him who has, you know, little, more will be taken. It's sort of like, you know, people think that like you can just ride inertia and not be moving. But what I've learned is that you are typically moving in one direction or another. And you need to try to evaluate, like, am I moving in the direction of I'm actually growing, or if you're sitting still, you're not sitting still. You're actually probably falling backwards, and you need to try to do something to turn that around.
Well, I think being stationary is entropic. Like if you are standing still, you are actually going backwards. Like you have to be challenging yourself to grow. It's like muscles, you know? Like if you're not tearing your muscles every day at the gym, they will atrophy. So I think it's the same thing with life. I think it's the same thing with finances. I think it's the same thing with relationships. Like if you aren't pushing forward with your relationship, it's probably degrading. And I think that's across the board, basically everything in life. So I don't, you know, it's the key is just not be afraid of it, to embrace that creative destruction process and to just like kind of reckless abandon. But as long as you're going after what you love, then all of the risks and everything else, you know, even the rewards, like they're kind of secondary, because it's, you only have one life, man. It's like, it's super gratifying or satisfying to feel as if you are pursuing what you're put on this planet to do. And if you don't feel that way and you do that every single day, I don't know how. Like that has to eat at people. And I think this is why, you know, they say most men live lives of quiet desperation. It's like, why do you want to live that way? And I think most people don't. I think most people don't want to live that way, but the fear outweighs the potential, you know, reward at the end. This is actually a big part of the reason I'm such a huge fan of Joe Rogan. Very much inspired me. I started listening in 2010. I started my company in 2011. You know, I was very inspired by the guy. And that's like everybody that I look up to is that type. Like, you know, Dave Smith, again, he's an entrepreneur. He really doesn't know much about being an entrepreneur. he's not much of a business guy, but he, because of his talent and because of his work ethic, he has managed to make himself an incredibly successful entrepreneur. But the key is that it's because he's focused on what he loves most in life, outside of his family.
Right.
And I think that's the way to live, man. Like if you ever want to be great at anything, you're going to have to be passionate about it. And if you're passionate about it, you will eventually be great at it.
Yeah. I agree. I want to read this super chat here quick from Henry Bingaman. Thank you, by the way, Henry. If you could make one of these people's ideologies irrelevant, which would you choose? A, Ben Shapiro. B, Klaus Schwab. Or three, I'm not good at Yuval Noah Harari. that's I don't know. That's
tough.
That is very tough. I mean, it's, you know, I'll speak on Ben Shapiro here for a second. Ben Shapiro is someone who's incredibly frustrating because he will get stuff what we're talking about in terms of Austrian theory and economics, and he's not the only person out there who like gets Austrian theory and gets understands, you know, the economic theory we're talking about, understands human action, but then fails to extrapolate the principles of that and how that applies to like pretty much every area of life. I think this gets to the other thing I wanted to talk about. There seems to be in the liberty movement two types of people. And I'm not the first person to make this observation, but there's some people who like they are libertarian in a sense, but they're like, well, the problem with the government is just that like it's in the way of the free market and it's inefficient and with all of its bureaucracies and it keeps people from living their best lives. But like ultimately, there's no difference between me and, you know, George Bush or Hillary Clinton or, you know, these DC elites and whatnot. Like, we're all just good people who want the same things, and we just have disagreements about that. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of people who are attracted to that, even in my world of Christians and whatnot, because I think one reason might be that they're naive. They haven't looked much into, you know, what's going on.
We're all created in God's image, so we're equal in that way. I mean,
there's that too. I think there's like the Christian impulse to love thy neighbor and even to bless those who persecute us. And listen, I pray for our leaders every day. Like, please stop. Like, praying doesn't mean you're supporting them. Praying means like repent. Like, stop committing these atrocities. But the second type of libertarian, which you and I are, you know, more of, and to me, I think this is the true spirit of libertarianism, is not like, okay, yeah, the government's inefficient, but that's not their main sin. Their main sin is that, like, it's evil, that they don't just stand in the way of human flourishing, they contribute to human suffering.
Yes.
And these people, it's hard to articulate this connection to people if they don't get it. But like the reason that like, you're very passionate about like markets and about investments and things like that, and I'm passionate about that stuff too, is that this isn't just numbers on a screen. These are human lives.
Right.
And when economies struggle, when they crash, right? When markets crash, that is real human suffering. And this corporatist system that we live in, where we see a lot of people, like I remember being a Bernie Sanders leftist. I remember talking about the 1%. We start looking into the 1% and realize, you know, how many of them are involved in banking, and how many are involved in the military industrial complex, and how many of them made their like I'm blanking on her freaking name. John McCain in heels. What's her name?
Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley. Yeah. Thank you. Like Nikki Haley. Like where'd she make her money? Right. There's a lot of people who are making their money not through free market exchanges, which like if someone's rich through free market exchanges, more power to them. But there's a lot of people who are making money by gaming this system in a way that allows them not only to extract wealth from the American people, but then to do so at the expense of the destruction of other people's lives and other people's countries and infrastructure and whatnot. And so these aren't just like separate spheres of conversation or of like analysis in human society that like, you know, we put on different hats. It's like, no, like this is all part of one cohesive puzzle that we need to try to understand if we're going to act in the world. And it's something that I want more Christians to wake up to. It's like Christians are called to love your neighbor, right? It's like, and we're called to take, you know, to be active in the world in terms of like the Bible says, like true religion is to take care of the orphan and the widow and the impoverished. It's like, well, in order to do those things effectively, you kind of need to understand how the world works and how to act in it and to understand what problems are plaguing the world and what the solutions are to them. And right. So anyway, I think this is, you know, these are the conversations that people need to be having more.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important. And to your point about, you know, like this is why I'm so passionate about economics, is that like, This is the wealth. This is the labor. This is the like the stored energy of every single person on the planet. Like that's what that's really at its core. Like what the monetary base is. I mean, it's not because it's manipulated, but you know what I'm saying? Like it's the delayed gratification, because otherwise you would have already spent that money. So any money that you've accumulated, that is all of your labor and efforts that are stored in these little, you know, energy pellets. And you could just have the government come in and just be like, slap your hand and have it all just go flying to the ground. And like that's totally evil. It's basically theft. So it makes me very mad that our system at its core is founded on there is no foundation to it. Like there is no foundation. This because the money supply is manipulated, because interest rates are manipulated, because they can either hyperinflate or create deflation in the market at any time at their discretion. They get to basically decide who succeeds and who fails, regardless of intelligence or effort or planning or anything else. Like they can just the best laid out plans of some of the best people ever got absolutely demolished in 2008, 2009. Like that's not fair. That's not okay. In fact, it's deeply immoral. And the people that are responsible for manipulating these levers that ruin these people's lives, they ought to be in prison for that. And I think that's the difference between me and a lot of libertarians too, is that like I look at the government and I say, not only do I think you're evil, but I think you ought to be in prison for what you're doing. And that includes the warmongers, obviously, even higher up on the list, that includes Anthony Fauci. And there's a lot of libertarians that have this strain of like, well, we can't use the state to put people in prison. It's like, well, if you're going to use the state for anything, it ought to be able to put the government officials in prison when they blow up innocent kids or when they, destroy the economy and shatter everybody's hopes and dreams. Like,
I hate when you say things like this. They're like, oh, come on, like, you know, we should be embracing civility and that's not like a civilized society. I'm like, what do you mean
society comes from justice,
right?
These people have to have justice for there to be civility. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I 100% right. It's like in like what part of civilized society, like civilized society isn't like making everything look nice and pretty and never having mean words to say, right? Like Jesus sometimes had very harsh words to say, and they were usually to the people who were in positions of power and authority. And so,
yeah. If anyone ought to be held to account, it's them. I mean, they are responsible for so much human suffering, and not just in America, all over the world. It's like, yeah, of course I have anger towards them. Now, that doesn't mean that like I'm going to be consumed by it. I'm still going to focus on my own life and my own well-being and my own happiness and everything else. Because if I were to obsess over it all the time, I would be destroyed by it. But if you're going to ask me for policy proposals, at the top of the list is going to be prosecute everyone responsible for the war on terror. prosecute everyone responsible for, honestly, I think that the central bankers, they ought to be in prison. I know that sounds kind of kooky, but I think like, at a minimum, it has to be abolished. And like that's bare minimum. And a lot of libertarians, even though they will say like end the Fed, like they don't have the same level of malice towards the central bankers as they do to Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney. And it's like, look, you can't even quantify how many people's lives were destroyed because of the central bankers. Like it's astronomical. And that is before the fall. That is before the hyperinflationary blowout or the deflationary death spiral. Like it is going to be catastrophic on a scale that's really hard for people to wrap their heads around. Now, it's not World War III level, but it's very, very catastrophic. So, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, you do that to the entire world, you deserve to be in prison.
Yeah, or something. I mean, there should be some form of justice.
I'm just trying to make news like sure. Dave Smith. I'm just trying to say something so bombastic that people write up articles and go, look at this guy's running for VP. He's out of his fucking mind. Sorry.
Right. Well, no, so we're going to get to that here. I mean, there's two comments I want to read here quick, which pertain to what we're talking about. One, to answer your question, Henry, which I should have answered more clearly, it is Ben Shapiro who I would want his ideology to go away, because at least the others are consistent, that they're just terrible across the board. And I can say that you are not me, right? But the problem with the Ben Shapiros of the world is that they allow people to kind of like have their statist cake and eat it too. that like he'll be like, oh yeah, I'm a libertarian or I'm libertarian leaning and I, you know, understand free markets and all that, but also we need to bomb Iran, right? It's like you can't, I'm sorry, like I think that there's something especially heinous about like there are wolves, but then the wolves who are in sheep's clothing, I think that there's something especially bad about that. And then
Was it getting rid of the person, or was it the ideology that
make the ideology irrelevant?
If that's the case, I go with Klaus, because he is I mean, even though the depopulation agenda from Noah Harari is obviously very concerning, but to be honest, every bad idea that Harari holds, Klaus holds too. But he's also responsible for propagating the ESG framework, which is basically created a global communist economy. So,
that's a problem.
That's a problem.
It's a problem. Well, so Hody's question here, you know, are there libertarians who don't see the government as a contributor to the problem? Well, this gets into, I'm not trying to play the no true Scotsman game. So like some of these people, I think, are just not real libertarians. But like you have people like Joshua Eagle going around saying like, no, NATO was good and dropping bombs on Japan was actually good. And like every result of post-World War II, centralizing of power and exercising of power by our federal government since World War II has basically been good. But I'm a libertarian. It's like, again, I think that there's something very, very disingenuous and very, very bad about that. And it gets into this, like, you know, I think some people, they either don't hate the government or they hate the government for the wrong reasons. Like they hate the government because like it's not generating more wealth for them to then extract and funnel towards their statist goals. Right. Yeah. It's almost like what's going on. It's this weird, like, vampiric, bastardation of libertarianism, where it's like, yeah, we want free markets so we can fund all the, all these wars and all these, initiatives that we want to, shove down people's throat. I mean, and Joshua is also a big proponent of globalization. And so he doesn't. Like you were just talking about in terms of the problem with Klaus and World Economic Forum and ESG and all this stuff. Yeah. Like he's not in opposition to any of that. He's like, oh, this is all fine. Like, you know,
as long as it brings gay rights to Uganda, then it's a good thing, right?
There's a third group of libertarians, by the way. There are libertarians in the middle who act like we can, like, that these other two groups should stop fighting. And I'm like, no, I don't have any beef with the libertarians in the middle who aren't as passionate about, you know, gatekeeping this other group out as I am. But I think that's a problem. It's like, I think that we're going to suffer as a movement if our message is diluted with people saying what you and I are saying. And then there's also people in one corner saying like the exact opposite, like championing on the worst parts of this current regime.
Yeah, they think NATO's awesome and World War III is just going to be super, super fun. Look, my perception, to answer his question directly, is that anybody that perceives the government not as a bad thing is not a libertarian. So yeah, that would be my answer. And as far as the slight to bordertarians, I think that's also nonsensical. If we want to get into that, we can. But I'm just going to let you. I'm going to let you feel that the open borders is the position that you should hold, and just continue to hold it. I don't really care.
Well, and you know what? Really, I'll just say something quick before we move on to the next subject. The point that I have ended up on the whole borders thing is that none of our debates are going to matter anyway, because the border policy is likely going to just stay what it is no matter what.
Correct.
But at the end of the day, I never want to be taking the side of what the state wants me to take the side of. And so, listen, my views haven't changed on this. I think that there are a lot of immigrants who are genuinely innocent people caught up in what is ultimately the consequences of state scheming and state, interventions and policies and whatnot. I'm not sure that libertarians should be We can be sympathetic to those people. We can even speak out against the instances in which governments are actively violating people's rights. But then we should also then not just be championing on the thing that the state wants us to champion on. That's part of their agenda. And I just think it's hard to look at what's going on right now and say that it's not orchestrated. So
it is orchestrated. Like, this is not debatable. And anybody that wants to debate me on it can, even though it would be pointless, as I've already said. But we are being robbed to fund the United Nations to the tune of billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of which then go to NGOs and to not-for-profits, and they are then helping expedite this immigration crisis. You don't 10x these numbers over a five-year period organically. It's nonsense. And I'm not talking about like just from the denouement, from the low point of 2020 during the lockdowns. I'm talking about during 05, 08, 12, we never approached anywhere near these figures. This is totally inorganic. This is obviously not just a federal government policy, but a United Nations, a global government policy. And you have libertarians that are advocating on behalf of that policy. It is insane. It is absolutely insane. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Feel free to support open borders. I don't really care. I'm just telling you, I ain't going to do it.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean I support closed borders either.
I don't either. Yeah, I support doubling legal immigration, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I think someone from the classical liberal caucus said, we should just have like 500 Ellis Islands. And I was like, that would be better than what we're doing right now. Yeah. there's a whole lot of room between the people who were kind of are living in Capistan in their head and, you know, complete closed borders where we can have good conversation. But that's been talked to death. Someone did ask a question. I'm trying to find it now. They asked what my what LP candidate do I support. Well, here at LCI, I cannot make proclamations of who I support or endorse. But I am sitting with someone who is seeking not the LP presidential nomination, but the vice presidential nomination. So my first question is why? because I don't know, I've been in the Libertarian Party for 5 years now, and it's only kicking and screaming that I've been, you know, detained and not allowed to leave, because it is it's a hard job to try to go out there and be involved in the political process, go out there and talk to people about right now. It seems like we are living in such a polarized moment, and those who are not caught up in Team Blue and Team Red seem very much, you know, on board with someone like RFK Jr. So I think the first question is, why are you seeking this nomination, and what do you hope to, if you get it, what do you hope to do, serving as the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party in a campaign like that?
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, first off, I think you're right, particularly with RFK Jr. running as an independent, which it looks 99% chance that that's what he's going to be doing. He's not going to be seeking the LP nomination. We're going to have the lowest, you know, election turnout in forever, decades, because almost all of the, you know, duopoly haters are just going to cast a vote for RFK because he has the most name recognition, whether or not they agree with him on principle or policy or anything like that. So he's going to absorb a huge amount of what Gary Johnson got and everybody else got. So we're going to get annihilated. So setting that aside, I'm not trying to win. just to be very blunt about it, have zero expectation of winning. In fact, I probably wouldn't be running if I thought I could win, because then I would be assassinated and I would like to live. So the reason I'm doing it is because I believe strongly in this message. And more than that, I believe strongly in this moment. Like, we need someone who's going to wake these people up. And Dave has that capacity. Obviously, the whole reason I got involved in this at all was because of Dave. He opted not to run for the presidential nomination. And I just felt like there was a void. I felt like the whole reason I got involved was because of Dave. And I wanted to support Dave, and I had told him repeatedly I would drop everything I was doing, the show with Luke and Liberty Lux, everything, and I would just dedicate whatever necessary to help him do as well as humanly possible with his campaign. Family conditions, everything else, he couldn't do it. So I saw, like, the Mises Caucus was basically, you know, Dave was our son, both S-U-N and S-O-N, and we were orbiting around him, and then he became a black hole, and then everybody's energy just kind of got sucked into it. And I was like, all right, well, I know that we still want to have someone that gets onto the largest platforms and says it to some extent how Dave might. All right. I don't see anybody else out there that is either willing or capable of doing it on the level that I think I can. So that's the reason that I was willing. That's it.
Yeah. You know, I think it would be useful to talk about what, because there's some people who left the Mises Caucus and the libertarian spaces because they were sort of like, they would agree with a lot of what we talked about just, I don't know, over the last 55 minutes of like, people need to be trying to become more economically independent, become entrepreneurs. You know, I remember that was the, God, I'm having like a terrible time with names tonight. Who's the guy, Wealth, Power, and Influence? Help me out here. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
I'm just forgetting everyone's name. People will know who I'm talking about. If it comes to you, you can say it. The Wealth, Power, and Influence guy. There's a lot of other people. I know Pete Quinones kind of said similar things to you for a while. Like, we just need people to become entrepreneurs, people to become rich and use that money to make themselves secure, make other people. So it's like, so why would you then, you know, like there's an opportunity cost if you're going to then, you know, get involved in politics. You're not even getting involved in politics to win. You're just getting involved to, you know, spread a message. Well, can't you do that anyway without politics? So what do you think about specifically doing this within the LP, doing this specifically in a presidential cycle? What do you hope to channel in terms of how this is going to help liberty or help the liberty movement, you know, broadly speaking?
Yeah, well, I mean, running...
Oh, Jason Stapleton. Thank you, JC.
Yeah, there you go. you know, running for president or vice president comes with it an imprimatur of legitimacy and authority that for a normie will make them more likely to listen to what you have to say. So I would like to have that. I would like to be able to go on Joe Rogan or PBD or any of these large podcasts and get to tell, you know, our story. And I don't really even perceive it as our story as much as it is like this is like the American story. Like what have we dealt with over the past 20 years? Like, are you happy with it? Because I can explain to you what's happened, and I can explain to you the power brokers that have you know, made your life far more challenging than it had to be. And like, I can show you the path forward too. And at the end of the day, hopefully I can inspire more people to go down the path that Quinones is describing of entrepreneurialism and things like that. So I'm not like relying on people getting involved with the LP and that being the end of their story. That should be the beginning, like the beginning of your story. And even if you don't get involved with the LP, like what matters is your life. And I think that's the message that oftentimes we fail to connect our principles and our ideology and our, you know, our party to that, you know, like how can this actually improve your life? And it can dramatically, but so often you will have a messenger whose life hasn't been improved from our ideology that's up there trying to spread it. And it's like, well, why should I listen to you, dude? And the answer is I shouldn't. I absolutely shouldn't. My life has been made incredibly, you know, luxurious because of my understanding of Austrian economics. I'm so fortunate that I found it at such a young age. And I'm so fortunate that I had the drive to use it in a way that could, you know, change my life. And just the ideology is beautiful, man. I think it's like, it's also just a message that the world needs right now. I want to get it to as many people as humanly possible. The whole reason I do a podcast in the first place is because of that drive. So if this enables me to get it to more people, why not?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of like the end all be all of it.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you know, Ron Paul certainly is sort of the archetype for what you're talking about there, and I think the LP is a useful, you know, it's a useful experiment what the Mises Caucus is doing, because rather than like trying to hope for once in a generation to get a Ron Paul, if you can have a political party that's routinely running that kind of messaging, running those kind of candidates, not just at federal, you know, elections, but also at state and local offices and trying to you know, also enact, you know, insofar as it can help spur on the other things, you know, nullify stuff at the local level. Right. I think there's a lot of utility to that. So I think it makes sense.
It, like all the same explanations Dave had for doing it, I have the same explanations. Now, can I talk that ish the way Dave does? Nah, not really. but I've got an insane amount of reps for someone who's only been doing this for less than 4 years. You know, Dave's been doing it for 15 or something. So like, give me a little grace here. Like I am 100% dedicated to this, and I will get better. And I think that like, we can't have all of our eggs in the Dave basket either. Like we're going to need, and I know Dave feels this way too. He wants there to be a dozen of us, 20 of us, some, you know, like if we're ever going to basically replace the neoconservatives, like we have to outwork them and we have to out audience them. We have to have more people that think that our ideas are worth listening to day in and day out than they do any of these other liars. So I think that's what I hope to do, man. I hope to provide backup to Dave and Massey and Rand Paul and anybody else that's like actually getting our message out there in a way that's landing with people.
Yeah, no, I think that there's something to also trying to like people think that that everyone has heard the libertarian message, and I think that is like the fundamental mistake of and listen, there's a lot of people who left who I still hold, you know, I think of them fondly. I have, you know, friendships with a lot of them, but they're kind of they have this mentality of like everyone's heard libertarianism already and have rejected it. I'm like, there are so many people who have no idea about Austrian economics, so many people that have no idea about the things that we're talking about. And
it's nonsense anyways, because even if they've heard it before, it was before lockdowns.
True.
It was before,
that's true. Yeah.
You know, like
we didn't exactly run a great message during the lockdowns. We had Jorgensen out there wearing masks, and I think Spike even, you know, probably regrets, you know, I think Spike's become a great messenger for the movement, but I think at certain moments that whole campaign could have just been done so much better, and they had such a missed opportunity.
Exactly. And like here's the thing. All I wanted in 2020 was someone like Dave to be telling the truth when it mattered most with a fearless, loud microphone, you know? And like, all I wanted was for that to be Dave in 2024 too. And it's like, all right, well, at what point do I stop looking for someone else to do it? And I just go, okay, I'm going to do it. Like I have to, like, cause otherwise I'm going to be let down. I know that for a fact. Like, who's going to say it the way I want it to be said? If it's not me, well, it's going to be me. Like that's how I'm going to do this. So, if the delegates want me, great. If they don't, that's totally fine. I'm still going to reach millions and millions of people over the next 12 months. I'm very comfortable with, you know, the way things were going prior to me announcing to do this. And if the delegates think that like my messaging style is too aggressive, then God bless. Then the party's not for me at that point. Cause like the whole reason the Mises Caucus took over, as far as I'm concerned, was because we wanted like not just like a Ron Paul style messenger, but like the key was to be honest when it mattered, not right later,
right,
not soft selling it, but like, okay, the lockdowns are announced. What's your take? Well, let's see what the science says before I give you my take. It's like, no, dude, like that's not the answer. Okay. So I think that's the main reason that I want to do this is like, I demand that we have at least one person in my lifetime that gets up there and like every single question that gets asked, I'm going to answer it right to the best of my ability, like fearlessly. I do not care about cancellation. I don't care about my future endeavors in corporate America. I don't care about getting a job on Boeing's board. I don't care about any of it. I don't care about literally none of it. Like I'm going to say the truth all the time, whether it's popular or not. And we'll see where the chips fall after that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of saying the truth when it matters most, I mean, obviously, you know, talking about the economic realities we're facing is always like an important thing to be talking about. But what are the most important things that not just you, if you win this nomination, but what do we as libertarians need to be saying the loudest? Like, what is the most uncomfortable or controversial or important truth that's not being said enough right now that Americans need to hear, in your opinion?
Oh, God. So there's so many, man.
pick two.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just go with like the first one that comes to mind is that we have to exit NATO. I think that it has essentially, like, if we don't, I feel like World War III is basically assured. And I think that the odds that we exit NATO are very low. So I think that World War III is very, very probable. And that scares me to death. And I feel like there is no one in the political establishment outside of Donald Trump occasionally or RFK Jr. occasionally that is being honest about the dire nature of what we face. So I think that's the first thing. I mean, to get back to, you asked me why I decided to do this. I really want to have kids, man. I really want to have a family, and I would like to have a freaking planet for them to exist on. So like that was my main driving factor in getting involved in all of this, is that like I genuinely perceive there to be existential threat to humanity. And I know that sounds like fear-mongering, and I know it sounds like hyperbole. It's not. I don't perceive it to be hyperbole at all. I wouldn't be saying it if I thought I was not telling you the truth. I think we are very, very close to an escalatory trap that ultimately ends with nuclear weapons flying. That cannot happen. So that's the first message that I think is the most important. We have to get people awoken to, you know, how dangerous this paradigm is. I'll just leave it at that, man. Second, I can do 1,000. There's right. 1,000 different
no,
things.
No, I think... I mean, leaving NATO and just, you know, like there's definitely a growing awakening of people who are starting to realize that the foreign policy of the last, 20 years, we could go further than that,
of course,
but especially the last 20, you know, 30 years has been a complete disaster. The whole split between Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro, which I do not think the Daily Wire, I don't think it's going as well for them as they might have hoped it would.
Which is great news.
Every day I see people on social media and YouTube comments saying, that's it, I'm canceling my Daily Wire membership. Now, listen, I am not, in some sense, I'm not like cheering Daily Wire to fail, because they are, to some extent, like, I hope, from my free market competition perspective, I had hoped that they would do well in terms of, like, that they were trying to compete against Disney and trying to compete against leftist media. And I was like, that's all good. Like, I hope you guys do that.
And Fox News and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, as far as I am a Christian and a conservative, even though I disagree with, like, Ben Shapiro and a lot of the people there's foreign policy and other things, I was like, I hope you guys, you know, create content that competes with those entities. And that's good in the overall culture and culture war and all that, but I think that they unfortunately sold their soul to the to this, you know, the Israel lobby, to this military machine, and that's where their loyalties ultimately lied. But I think a lot more people are attracted to the message that Candace Owens was saying, which is like, you know what, she was like, I remember when she had Dave on, she said we were sold these lies after September 11th, and people are like, I think there's so many people in conservative ink who just want people to like take the blue pill and just like put themselves back into the matrix.
Yeah.
But people just aren't going to do that. Like they see how disastrous these military interventions have been. They see how it's bankrupting us. They see how it's sending our not just our men, but our children. We're sending our children overseas to commit these acts of violence that scar them for life. Like, I remember I've had conversations with people at my church when they hear my views, and they'll sometimes like initially be offended and be like, why, you know, like, what do you think about, you know, like, there'll be parents be like, why, well, my son enlisted in the military, do you think that's a bad thing? And I was like, no, like, I think if you have a heart to want to like protect your country, I'm not shaming that. I'm saying I don't want your son to go and be as a young person manipulated to go blow up brown children in the name of freedom, and then be scarred for life because of that, and potentially commit suicide because of that, which is unfortunately an all too common tale in America today. And then, as you said, this is all contributing towards making all of us less safe. And that, I know that's not what people's hearts are when they want to, you know, serve in the military or support the military, but that's the honest truth of how they're being used by our political elite. And so I kind of agree. I think the most important thing we can be doing right now is, and no matter where those alliances are to be found, like, I don't care if I have to join hands with bleeding red communists when I'm protesting these wars, you know, on the steps of DC. We need to be doing everything we can to force the political establishment to give up this bloodlust that they have.
Exactly. And let's also add, like, the whole reason that the BRICS alliance is so strong and growing and adding nations seems like monthly, is because of NATO. Like, it's not just NATO. It's the NATO and the petrodollar and the defense of the U.S. dollar and the sanction regime that they levy against any nation or any leader that tries to get people off of the petrodollar. By that, for the layman audience, I just mean the U.S. dollar. But like, that is creating this bifurcated world where it doesn't need to exist. We do not need to have, you know, the Axis and the Allies all over again. Like, I have no animosity in my heart towards the average Chinese or Russian person or Iranian, for that matter. We don't need to perceive each other to be each other's enemies because our leaders are, you know, waging war with one another over which fiat piece of garbage currency they're going to use. Like, this is all unnecessary. It is all to our detriment. It is not to our benefit in any way. And it doesn't need to be happening. So, like, that message is very important. I think that's it. Like I said, if there was one message I could get into not just people's like minds, but into their hearts, like, that's what I want people to hear. So, you know, yeah. We'll see. I like these are all, like, you know, the way I see Ron Paul is, like, he seeded the ground, you know, like we plant seeds for trees we don't get to rest in the shade of. Like, that's what libertarians are. And yep. I know that may sound like a disenchanting or kind of sad perspective, but it's kind of true. You know, like, our ideas ultimately get adopted sometimes decades too late and sometimes decades, you know, later than than we started to talk about them. But that doesn't matter. Like, the ideas are necessary to, you know, be planted. And I just hope to continue in that process of our long legacy of planting the seeds of these ideas that are necessary for a functioning world.
Yeah. Well, and this will be a good question to end on. We had another super chat from Henry. Thank you, Henry. What both your calculus for I'll fight to save the country versus it's time to leave? What would be the point where you say I'm out of here? I'll answer first, then I'll let you answer to kind of close us out, Clint. For me personally, although I guess I could, like, come up with a weird hypothetical where I would say, yeah, I'm out. For the most part, I have kind of said, you know, my line in the sand is here. Like, I feel like we need to say, I'll draw an allusion to Lord of the Rings, like Gandalf, just put your stick in the ground and say, you know, no, like, you will not pass. We are not. I have kids, right? And it's not easy for me to think, like, because we have two options, right? We either make it work here or I go somewhere else in the world and then I hope that I don't become the victim of our American foreign policy. So right. There's not many places in the world that are safe from the finger of American imperialism. So I think if we give ourselves if it gets this bad, I'm gonna give up on this. Like, no, like we need to tell ourselves that this really of nuclear war is not going to spare anyone, or I at least wouldn't bank on it. If that's, and I agree with you, that's, although I'm not saying that is, you know, the extreme high probability, it is, you know, the highest it's been in probably either of our lifetimes, and certainly too high to find acceptable for any person who's paying attention and who has a stake in the survival of their future generations, which I do. And so no, we have one planet, we have one nation. I have, you know, my kids, and I have, you know, this life. And although I am a Christian and I believe in a life after that, you know, my faith convicts me to say that I'm told to be bold and courageous. I'm told to speak truth and to bring light into darkness. And I'm, you know, I need to model that for my kids. And so I'm going to stand up and say, no, like, you know, I'm going to say in the most important battle that I had to face in my adult life, I didn't back down. I didn't take try to find the easy way out. I'm going to continue to say what needs to be said and do what I can to coalition with the rest of the liberty movement and the rest of the anti-war movement to say, we're not going to allow you to continue to sabotage and steal the future of our children. Like, I'm not going to accept it.
Yeah. Well, I read this a little bit differently, so I'll give a different answer. But, you know, my concern, he says, I'll fight to save the country. And it's like, well, the implication there, I read as an invasion, like we're being invaded. I probably wouldn't at this junction, because the reality is that I wouldn't be really so much defending my land as I would be defending this government. And my belief is that this government is as needing of toppling as any other on the planet, basically. So I can't envision myself, fighting to protect this dirt, because like the ideas are what matter to me most. And the ideas are not held by the majority of Americans, and they're not held by basically anyone in power outside of Thomas Massey. So like, if the Chinese were to invade, I would probably, like, I'm just being honest, I would probably leave. Like, I would probably leave. I'm sorry. Like, in 1990s, Clint, the answer would have been, you know, heels dug in, let's go. But that's just not how I feel about this country.
I don't know. I guess I'm a little optimistic on that front. Like, I feel like there is still enough of Americans who are armed who would stand up.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
For the record, but like, I'm not going to risk my life to defend this government, you know. Like, that's
sure. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I guess but you and I agree, like, I don't think that's likely to happen.
There's basically a 0% chance that America ever gets ground invaded, aside from us being disarmed a la the UK, Australia.
Well, yeah, that's why, you know, Spike Cohen did that debate with David Hogg the other day. And like, I just feel like people need to, this is what I love about Candace Owens. And we'll end on this. Like, she actually, in her podcast, which I hope she brings back soon, she goes back and talks about history, and including uncomfortable parts about history that people don't want to talk about. But it's just like, listen, people have bought into the delusion that atrocities that happened in history cannot happen here.
Right.
That there's no way that our government could ever become so evil as to, you know, to lock us up, or to, you know, commit
lockdown,
you know,
the economy,
massive acts of violence. But yeah, lock people. Like, the government would never lock people in their homes or arrest
and
parents
and force them to put
the parks or
force them to put experimental stuff in their body against their will. At loss of their job. It couldn't happen in America,
right.
Actually.
And it did. And
yeah. And there's been no justice for it either. So you don't live in a free country. It's really important that people just kind of wrap their heads around that one. If you didn't figure it out after 2020, 2021, I don't know what else you got to see. That's the major reason that I'm not interested in fighting for this country. It breaks my heart to say that. I'm still very much interested in fighting for the belief system, the principles that this country was founded on, which 95% of which I agree with. So that's what I'm fighting for. And if there was ever that fight on this ground, I would stand for it. But if it's like, if it comes down to, you know, two nuclear powers that are duking it out to decide which fiat currency gets used for the rest of the next century, count me out. I don't want to fight that fight.
No, I hear what you're saying. Clint, I appreciate you coming on. You're a very busy man. You do a lot. Tell people where they can find you. Tell people, you know, not just for your podcast and the show you do with Luke as well, but also, social media. I don't know if you have a site up for the vice presidential run, but anything you want to plug before we hop off here.
At Liberty Lockpod on X. That's where most people know me from. Liberty Lockdown on YouTube, Liberty Lockdown on Rumble. I love this country. I hate this government. As Josie said, I could not agree more. I also do The Best Political Show with Luke Radowski. It's all one word, We Are Change, over on Rumble. We have an exclusive deal over there. We go live 3 nights a week with different guests from all throughout the political spectrum, and it's really, really fun. I also do Tower Gang, which you should never, ever watch. And what else? As for the VP run, I'm not trying to, like, take this super seriously until I get the nomination. The nomination is at the end of May. I would imagine there are some delegates that will watch this at some point. So if you appreciate, you know, my candor, and you think that I would do a good job, I would appreciate your support as a delegate. And if you don't agree with that, then vote your conscience.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Clint, for coming here to talk about this stuff with me. I hope that the audience enjoyed it. Thank you all for listening or watching or, you know, however you consumed this. And yeah, as I always close the show with saying, I'll talk to you next time. Until then, live at peace and live for Christ. Take care.